Welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. So glad to have you with us on this show. It's just weeks from the vernal equinox, and Alaskans are starting plants for summer gardening. And the Alaska Botanical Garden is having its spring garden conference soon. And what that means for Talk of Alaska is that they find some wonderful, thoughtful guest to bring on to Talk of Alaska. And that's the case this time, as we will hear in a moment. But let's start with the executive director of the Alaska Botanical Garden, Julianne McGinnis. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Welcome back, Julianne.
Thanks, Steve. Glad to be here.
So the garden, of course, for those who don't know, is located kind of off of Tudor Road, over getting towards the hillside, but not on the hillside.
Right on the edge of Midtown on Campbell Airstrip Road, a block south of Tudor.
And every year, along with being kind of a community, I guess you could say a repository of plant material, interpretive center. It's also, this gardening conference has become so huge that it's outgrown its venue now.
It's fantastic, yeah. This gardening, of course, is a hot topic these days as people want to grow their own fruits and vegetables and herbs. And so this garden conference promises to be another great one. And we're at the Millennium Hotel this year.
Wow, down on Lake Spinard.
That's right.
Well, that will be something. And is there a overall thrust this year on biodiversity and ethnobotany and that sort of thing? And maybe you can just give me a little sketch of what your theme is.
There sure is. This year's conference is called Traditions and Transformations, and the theme is definitely, as you say, ethnobotany, biodiversity, and food. Definitely growing food. We've got talks on organic veggie growing, how to grow fruit here in Alaska, building a better rock garden, why become an ethnobotanist in a world gone mad.
that sounds good.
How the common vegetable seed can save us. And we have a special keynote. We're thrilled to have Gary Paul Nabhan with us from Arizona. Gary is going to speak twice, once on Friday night and once on Saturday. If many of you may be familiar with Gary's books, he's written on biodiversity, food, and culture, and he's going to speak on the traditional foods at risk in Salmon Nation, threatened wild and cultivated plants on Friday evening. And then on Saturday, he'll talk about plants, pollinators, and climate change, what gardeners can do.
What gardeners can do. Gary Paul Nabhan, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm so excited I have a chance to get up your way and meet all the great people that are doing such innovative.
Oh, we're losing phone connection. Is that a radio phone? Oops. You know what? I guess we got to go back to the cell phone there. Oh, well. He is talking to us from Nogales in Arizona. He is the chairman of the Sustainable Food Systems Program in Southwest Borderlands Food and Water Security at the University of Arizona College of Social and Behavioral Science. How's that? That's a mouthful,
That's
isn't
a mouthful.
It? But what he likes is basically ethnobotany and terroir and food. And when I started researching, I plugged into a lecture that he gave, and he got me with something that I cannot forget when he said, "What will I taste like?" Wow.
Powerful stuff. Powerful stuff.
Yes. As we will hear, he has a rather creative and poetic turn of mind, and should be really exciting. And you're actually getting him to talk about Alaska.
That's right. That's right.
Plants and animals and things under threat and things like that.
You know, I was recently in Gary's homelands in down near the Tucson area and visited the Native Seed Search, which he had founded, and was just fascinated by what's going on down there. There's a lot of activity, as there is here and everywhere else in the country these days, about trying to preserve local food sheds and improve food security. People are so interested in growing their own heirloom vegetables and fruits. And so Gary's done some fantastic work down there. And I think we have some things to learn about how to improve Salmon Nation's biodiversity.
Well, if nothing else, it's a subject of endless fascination. Mm-hmm. I mean, any gardener knows that, you know, you can carry on for 70, 80 years, and you're still learning something new every year. I think our connection is reestablished. Gary, are you back with us on your cell phone?
Yes, I am. I hope this is better. Sorry, whatever the connection problem was, I'm back listening with you, so happy to be here.
Okay. Well, no, it's really great to have you, and you'll sound a lot more clear when you get up here for the Garden Conference, which is when?
The Garden Conference kicks off on Friday evening at 6:30 p.m. over at the Millennium Hotel, and Gary will speak, give his keynote talk that night. That's Traditional Foods at Risk in Salmon Nation, Threatened Wild and Cultivated Plants. And then the conference resumes all day Saturday, a big, long day Saturday with some fantastic talks. I think we have about 20 sessions, four going simultaneously. And that's, again, at the Millennium Hotel from about 9:30 a.m. until 5:30 p.m.
Well, Salmon Nation would give an indication, Gary, that you know a little bit about what's going on up here in Alaska.
Well, I'm still a beginning student, but I have a good friend, Richard Nelson, in Sitka, who I visited a number of times, and we've gone out to see the herring roll on cedar boughs and dug for wild roots and gone halibut and salmon fishing and things like that. So I'm a rank beginner in your neck of the woods, but it always excites me to be up there. And I think one thing that most people in the lower 48 don't understand is what great gardens you all have and that there's such wonderful food traditions. Once when I gave a talk in Sitka, some Tlingit people came up and said, you know, you were talking about a unique potato down with the macaw in Washington State. We have a potato, too, that was brought in early by the Europeans that we've been taking care of for decades, if not centuries. And so there's some hidden gems in Alaska that I think need continent-wide or worldwide celebration, some of these food traditions that are so unique that literally only those of you in Alaska know them, and I think they're just wonderful and deserve more recognition.
Well, I think the question I'm going to put, because it is a call-in show for our listeners all across the state of Alaska, is one that people in many parts of the state might be able to relate to. Maybe it's a crazy question, but because I know I am not capable of this, but I'm wondering if it's possible, if people think that they can, distinguish where a salmon comes from by its taste. In other words, can you tell which river it came from? Can you tell a Copper River from a Yukon River? Well, that's probably even I could do that. But from say, Kenai, I could tell you, can you tell Bristol Bay from Southeast? Anyway, so maybe that's the question. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. The food of the place is the subject today on Talk of Alaska, and how foods taste different where they're from. I think we might be able to, just like you could say with berries, can you tell, you know, just like you can say with salmon, can you tell where salmon comes from by its taste? Some people might say you could do it with berries.
You know, I just read Gary's book, Desert Terroir, and was fascinated about how he can weave together information about food and culture and the terroir of a place. Gary, can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, yes. Each different soil type, each different microclimate really shapes the chemicals in a fruit in particular, but we also get this in meats and in fish. So that, for example, with the heat and drought that we have here, the plants put out a lot of very strong aromatic oils on their leaves that are both very fragrant and taste, there's power to their taste because they're so concentrated.
the Mexican oreganos and the wild chilies we have here are very potent because of the limestone soils and hot, dry conditions we have here. But it's true even in northern climates. People in Canada can tell maple syrup that comes from shale or schist or granite soils because they taste differently. In blindfold tests, most of the people in the country can tell which maple syrup is theirs, of their soil type, versus ones from other places. So I think unconsciously we sense these things, but we may not be able to put a technical name on it. We don't know the chemical that's doing that, but our senses can pick that up.
Yeah, you know, it's you certainly have terroir when it comes to wine, and some people could probably get it on maybe beer, although there's a lot of processing in beer. Certainly in cheeses, people can make those distinctions. But I think you're right. We don't read, for wine, we have all these terms, these terms that people, all the different ways you can taste wine have all been codified, and some have more.
That's right.
Yeah, but I guess for maple syrup, you don't have a vocabulary for maple syrup.
Right, right. But oysters, people do have that vocabulary like they do for wine, and so each different bay is renowned for a different tasting oyster, and some of that has to do with water temperature and that kind of thing, but a lot of it has to do with the substrate as well. So I think most people who are seafood connoisseurs have some inkling of what we're talking about.
Well, let's test it on Jason from the Copper Valley. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jason.
Yeah, good morning. You're mentioning the taste of food, and the one thing I wanted to say that Alaskan carrots taste way better than anything else.
Amen.
I definitely have to attribute that to, soils and the fact that it's all good, healthy soil still. And the other one is for salmon, vast difference in salmon prices. And if you look at it, the natural biology, the Copper Rivers are running up glacial streams, really hard, strong, running in the spring. Yukons are running up slow, longer rivers. The Bristol Bay is running up slightly longer rivers, a lot more lake traffic there. And so each salmon has a different environment it's working on, and, they're going to turn out stronger, yummier for all those same reasons. Anyways, I just wanted to chime in about carrots and salmon.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the carrots too, Jason. Thank you very much. It's Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255. And he comes from, Gary, he comes from the Copper Basin, so he's going to be very, very familiar with the Copper River salmon.
I think Copper River salmon are terrific. They're just otherworldly to those of us down here where we hardly have any water in our river, so... I envy him.
Yeah, we're talking to Gary Paul Nabhan of University of Arizona, and he's talking to us by telephone from Nogales, but he's on his way up to Alaska later on this week for the annual gardening conference, the Spring Garden Conference of the Alaska Botanical Garden. We also have with us Executive Director of Botanical Garden, Julianne McGinnis, and maybe we could go into this a little bit, Gary, about the importance of biodiversity for resilience. The way that the plants and microbiota are connected makes them stronger, basically, and more resistant to swings in climate and other environmental factors.
That's right. If we plant an orchard with a dozen or two dozen kinds of apple trees, I have 70 kinds of fruit trees, different varieties in the orchard that I'm looking out over from the window in my kitchen where I'm sitting right now. If we have 70 kinds of varieties, if the weather begins to shift, some of those may not make it through every year, but certainly others will, and that redundancy, that not putting all your eggs in one basket, so to speak, is this idea of resilience, that we have different backup strategies, in our fruit trees. If our favorite apple fails, we still have others that we can rely on. And so as climate shifts, not everything that our parents or grandparents grew in a place may still grow in the place, whether it's a garden or an orchard, like it did when we were children. But that diversity can still give us great pleasure and enjoyment and contribute to our food security.
Yeah, you know, I was at a presentation, a symposium where Camille Parmesan was talking, University of Texas. Maybe you're acquainted with her work. She's documented like 4,000 species that are under stress right now. And she was saying that often what will happen is that the lower elevation plants under heat stress and animals even more will tend to rise up in elevation. And then in the higher elevations now, we've had so much thrashing around of the climates that it's getting crowded up there. And she said the other thing that's needed is you've got to have ways that they can migrate and can move, and often the you know, there's things in the way now.
That's right. So people are talking about concepts such as assisted migration, so that if a particular kind of berry that's on one island off the coast has its climate change radically, people are moving it northward up to an island maybe 50 miles north. And this is happening in the Gulf of California, where I do some fishing, where we have a little fishing cabin along the border. People are beginning to actively consider, well, maybe we should make an additional sanctuary for this lizard or berry or whatever it may be, so that there's sort of a backup plan in place. And certainly, Alaska is undergoing a rapidity of changes in seasonality, much more severe than people in the lower 48 are paying attention to. But keep in mind that two-thirds of the lower 48 suffered severe drought this year. We had more counties in the United States and provinces in Canada declared drought disaster areas than ever before in American history. So these aren't things that we're waiting for to happen that we need to be planning for, because they may happen someday. They're already happening to us.
They're already happening.
And it has fascinating implications for our food shed, for our food security up here, and you know, both within the state and what we bring up from the lower 48, since so much of Alaska's food is supplied from external to Alaska.
Yeah, the I think that that's certainly the case on the talk show. That people want to talk about food security, and have for certainly the last 2 years. But what we're seeing now, what with the droughts in some prime cropland, we're actually seeing yields starting to top out for feed grains and so forth like that over the last couple of years. And it's making the thoughtful, the people that have to think in terms of agricultural policy and things like that, pay a lot more attention to food security all of a sudden. And meanwhile, here in Alaska, well, it's still a frontier. You know, I'm convinced Alaska sooner or later will produce a lot more than salmon.
Absolutely. And it's we need to be very aware of the opportunities right now as we design our food systems for stability and resilience here in Alaska. We really need to consider making sure we attend to biodiversity preservation in our food systems.
Well, it's root cellars they really want to talk about, I'll tell you that. Yeah, go ahead, Gary.
I think the best film on these topics that I've seen in the last 5 years isn't King Korn or some of the other fast food nation or ingredients from the lower 48, but Eating Alaska is a wonderful film asking people to consider what their food choices are. I don't think the intent was to give people answers like there's one way to eat in Alaska, but rather show the various approaches that people are taking and their social values and moral values embedded in those choices. And I think it's so witty and engaging film that everyone in the world should see because it shows that these aren't easy decisions to make.
That's Eating Alaska by my friend Ellen Frankenstein.
That's a wonderful Sitka film, yeah. I'm really glad you brought that up, and it's so weird to hear somebody in Arizona talk about it. Let's go to Bob, joins the program from Soldotna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Oh, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Well, yeah, you mentioned the equinox, and the return of the sun to the northern arboreal forest is a good thing to feel the heat and the warmth of the sun, which
Amen.
We all know gives growth to our biodiversity. And you mentioned things pretty much in the state of Alaska. I lived pretty much in the state of Alaska 54 years. And I've tasted halibut from southeast. I've tasted halibut from Cook Inlet and Tasiilaq. In the last several years, I've eaten here in the Kenai and Tasiilaq. And, well, it's a real fine line between their other than size and the color on their backs, which are the Kenai bluebacks. And I have a native friend who grew up in Bristol Bay that can tell the difference in taste, and I can tell the difference in taste between moose and where they came from.
Wow.
Caribou I haven't eaten in many, many years, but we have a great difference in soils, diversity up here in Alaska, and the difference in soils, many things I mentioned. You know, it's like Idaho, because potatoes, you know, Idaho was always famed on their potatoes because of their soil composition there, being from the last volcanic, I guess, stages of that area and the soil. And berries, I haven't had the chance to pick berries in a long time, but I'm sure that it makes a lot of difference what part of the state they came from. You know, blueberries up here, they say, are real high in, I can't remember what it was.
The anthocyanins, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And Alaskan blueberries are much higher than that, than anywhere else in the country, I guess. But I just wanted to call and say hello and enjoy your show, Steve. And you've always got a good range of topics. And I'm sorry I missed out on Story of Stuff. That would have been a great one for me.
Oh, she's a hero. she's a real hero.
Yeah. Celebrate the return of the sun to the northern forest, and you folks have a good day, and thank you for taking my call.
All right, Bob. Yeah, thank you very much. And he's given us a good deal of food for thought there. It occurs to me that what we're talking about here really, Gary, is a kind of a change in the way that we just look at our food. Have we lost him?
I'm back. I don't know what happened.
Okay. Yeah, a change in the way that we look at our food. I mean, it's really interesting hearing Bob say, well, now that I think about it, not only can I tell halibut, but also moose. and then I realized, geez, you know, I might even be able to tell moose, too. I just don't have a good enough experience base and haven't applied that much thought to it. But it probably, if we did, a lot of that knowledge is still there. And I guess that's part of what you're arguing.
Well, yes, there's traditional knowledge, not only in Alaska Natives, but in subsistence hunters about all of this. And at the same time, if you're a naturalist or ecologist, you can make certain predictions about it, too. It may not always come true, but one thing we know is that oysters in colder water tend to taste better when you get down to Southern California and the Gulf of California, where I get oysters. It just doesn't have the same sharpness and fullness of flavor. We know that salmon put on more fat tissue and that there's higher omega-3 fatty acid contents in your salmon than salmon from Washington and Oregon or Northern California, because the cold water, again, encourages the fish to put on higher levels of fat because of the cold water. So some of this is predictable if you think about what you're eating through the eyes of an ecologist. So I think there's different entry points to this. It's like light shining into a prism from different angles.
Yeah. So what are you going to talk about when you get up here in Alaska? We talked a little bit about the salmon. What's the other one you're going to take up?
Well, I'm very much interested in the distinctiveness of these foods and how we need to guard against people mixing them up, moving oysters around or something just because something has a sort of buzz about it. Some of the heirloom vegetables, the root crops and all of that sort of go in and out of fats, and I think we need to encourage people to hang on to the historic vegetables that have done so well in a place over time rather than succumbing to some of these fads and just following whatever the new thing is in a garden catalog. There's a lot of time-tried variety selection that's happened in Alaska, just like there's time-tried knowledge that works there for gardening. And I think we need to celebrate that rather than think there's some cookie-cutter formula to gardening that works, you know, anywhere in the world. So I really think that a lot of my message is very simple. Celebrate the uniqueness of your place through the plants and the foods that you eat there. And there's certainly a lot of you in Alaska that have that part of your lifestyle. You probably have more people who talk about such things in Alaska than any part of the country because it's just part of what people do, whether they're hunters or foragers or gardeners.
Do you have you ever heard about the thing that the mice do out there on the tundra where they basically gather all these tubers that I didn't even know about and they store them for their own food, but it's not all that hard to find it if you know how to do it, and people do. The indigenous people, the Yupik people, know how to do this, and I've never actually tasted any of this, but they love it. They say that's one of the great treats. And that's just one.
Well, I've actually done it. Bizarrely, I've done an article in an ethnobotany journal on that phenomenon. Lewis and Clark survived one winter on the food that the rodents gathered. So it's something that isn't just an anomaly. It was literally done over a 1,000-mile gradient down the west coast and inland up into the upper Missouri River Valley, and it's, of course, different mice and different tubers each place. But one way to look at it is this way. If for every 10 calories that a mouse gathers, if we eat the mouse, we get one calorie. Why not just eat what the mouse has gathered rather than eating the mouse? Just let them gather the food for you, and then you don't have this loss of a tenth of the caloric value by eating the mouse instead of all the food that he's cached.
I have never
but
thought
it's
of...
it's really a good phenomenon.
That is a form of animal husbandry that cooperative extension has not thought of yet.
Well, it's what I call it. It's an energetic short circuit. You're sort of multiplying the value of what's out there rather than decreasing it. But there's intricate indigenous knowledge among First Nations peoples about this, and it's dozens of different cultures that practice this technique, particularly in the winter and spring.
Well, thank you. Stay with us, please. We're going to take a break here. Gary Paul Nabhan of the University of Arizona College of Social and Behavioral Sciences with us from Nogales. Julianne McGinnis, Executive Director of the Alaska Botanical Garden. We're talking about the upcoming garden conference, and we're talking about our food as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
It's talk of Alaska. The need to feed the world has become a major preoccupation of this scientific world, but how to do it is a major debate. Some look to fish farming and genetic modification of crops. Some look into the ecosystem and find potential there. And some look at our own bodies and suggest we change the way we eat. And many now say all of the above in our bodies, in the oceans, and on the land. Agronomists, marine and terrestrial biologists, economists, earth-sensing specialists, hydrologists, geneticists, and many more are all at work. Microbiologists are learning that fungi, bacteria, and even plant viruses can have a dramatic impact on crop yield and drought, heat, and cold tolerance. Wild plants in their communities tend to do better under stress than crops. Still, the changing climate is pushing all sorts of plants and animals to the edge of their ecological niches and sometimes beyond to extinction. And this prompts some researchers to look at resilience. And they find that resilience is a matter of plant and animal communities, right down to their genetic variability and the genes of microorganisms and viruses. We are what we eat, but each one of us is an ecosystem of food preparation, taste, digestion, and metabolism that involves microorganisms, enzymes, and anatomy. A team at Harvard University says dietitians are even looking at calories all wrong by not considering our own metabolism and the microorganisms in our bodies. So a can of corn you buy in the store is more different than we thought from corn you just picked, but it's also not even the same as a can of corn you grew yourself. Enter the concept of food shed, and that's what we're talking about here. The Alaska food shed and food sheds all across the country. Gary Paul Nabhan is the editor of a book about Salmon Nation, and we're in Salmon Nation. And is Gary back with us now? Okay. And so we're connected with him from Nogales. And we're also talking with another one of the people who, the ethnobotany people, who will be speaking at the garden conference put on by the Alaska Botanical Garden, who joins us right now. And I'm glad to have her with us, Rose Meyer of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Kuskokwim campus by telephone from Fairbanks. Rose, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate the opportunity to join in on this conversation. It's very exciting to hear about the efforts that are going on for the Garden Conference, and also I'm looking forward to meeting Gary Paul at the meeting as well. So,
and your subject will be?
One of three. There's a team of us that are going to be converging at the meeting, and we're going to talk about ethnobotany. And I believe the title of our talk is the one that you said, oh, that sounds neat, and I can't remember what it is now. But
it's why become an ethnobotanist in a world gone mad.
That's right. And that was our internist, Leah Walsh's brilliant idea. That was her input. It's so wonderful having young people and having their energy involved. So, yes, we're going to talk about the program that we have started in Bethel at the Kuskokwim campus. Give a brief introduction to that, and then we're going to have a little bit of hands-on tapping people's inner ethnobotanist exercise. So a little bit, ethnobotany is a very traditional, old activity, but it's something that's very new to people, the term, and so we're just going to bring people along with letting them know what ethnobotany is today and what we're doing here in at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and also how people are already doing it themselves.
Well, I guess what Gary has pointed out, really, that a lot of this is just there in folk knowledge and in just about everybody, wherever you grew up, whatever you grew up with and learned to use and eat and so forth like that. But bringing that together with the academic world is maybe what the field is about.
It's exciting. It's an exciting old new field, I guess. It's actually very interdisciplinary, and it has had, for that reason, it doesn't lay comfortably within an academic setting per se, because we don't fit in any traditional fields. But that's also where the exciting part is that it is interdisciplinary, and it is brings together anthropology, sociology, botany. Some people are interested in it from a business aspect. Some people are interested in from an art or a spiritual aspect. So, it's a very exciting time to be starting to do this here in Fairbanks.
I love the idea of exploring your inner ethnobotanist.
Well, everyone has associations with plants, even people that are very urban. They have certain plants that they connect with, and that's ethnobotany right there.
Wow. So. Yeah, you've connected with it. Well, you know, chickweed is the one that I seem to be always connected with. I understand it.
Julianne perhaps has something on that.
And you know, chickweed's a wonderful plant. It's a healing plant.
It is.
And yeah. Edible.
Yeah, but I mean, kind of watery. And we have a stack of calls and emails and everything, and I think we should be getting to some of them. This one's from John, who says, my grandmother, who lived and was raised in Ugashik, could tell the difference between Bristol Bay red salmon and Lynn Canal red salmon. She said that Haines salmon was too salty for her tastes. When she started the winter in Haines, she would put up all her fish in Ugashik and bring them down to Haines. I haven't had a chance to do this taste test myself. You know, the tundra, but not really tundra, but the kind of ground there is in the delta area around Bethel has always looked to me like kind of a monoculture, but I guess it's not.
No, it's not. You should take our class, Steve. You'd enjoy it.
I'd love it. I'm sure I would love it.
We have a large diversity of very short stature plants, so you need to get down and look at them closely. But actually, we have elders that we work with, and our program is founded in elder knowledge, Yupik Chupik elders, and so we have a couple of them in Bethel that actually do tundra walks. And the next time you're in Bethel and in the summer, you can ask us, and we'll hook you up.
Oh, fantastic. You were probably listening when Gary was talking about Lewis and Clark finding the rodent caches. And I assume they're probably doing that. You're probably associated with, you probably know some elders and know how to do that.
Yes, absolutely. The mouse middens are very important. They have their own names for that. Absolutely. And there are lots of nutrients in there as well. Yeah, true.
Darren joins the program from Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Darren.
Thanks a lot, Steve, and hi, Julianne.
Hi, Darren.
It's good to hear this show, and I'm a big fan of yours, Gary. And once I read your book, Where Our Food Comes From, and the work of Nikolai Vavilov, I'm really looking forward to reading your new book, Salmon Nation. And
oh, thank you.
I was really glad, being down here in Southeast, that you mentioned the macaw potato In this area, you know, it's called the Haida potato or the Tlingit potato. And
that's right.
And some of our native elders here, Dick and Nora Dauenhauer, most recently are credited for bringing and spreading the what they call the Maria's potato, named after their friend Maria, up in Klukwan, just north of Haines. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but they are genetically identical, the macaw and the Haida potatoes and the Tlingit potato. And I think it's still, the jury's still out as to whether it was brought up by Europeans or whether it was traded all the way up originally from Chile, potentially.
And doesn't it predate the potatoes that were from Peru and Ecuador? Isn't this more genetically similar to the...
This is a show on its own. This is great.
Yeah, sir. It's so interesting. I know that at least that it was shown genetically not to be from the Russians, which was the original thought. So it did come up from the south there along the way. But I also I also wanted to just share with you, I'm really sorry that I'm not going to be able to make the conference this year. And Julianne, I hope that there's at least some tapings of Gary's and Rose's talk. Sound wonderful. But just the idea of celebrating the food of our place, that's something that I really focus on as a UAF cooperative extension agent here in Southeast and statewide. The wild and cultivated plants of Alaska are just so rich in diversity and for feeding us all. I just want to also call attention to the work I do with the Alaska Food Policy Council. That's a statewide organization for everybody who's listening, everybody who's interested in food in Alaska. The Alaska Food Policy Council is working to try and strengthen our food system, looking at all elements, wildcrafted, transportation, storage, local food production, the whole gamut. And we're doing things with to try and support, like the governor's working group is a continuing resolution that's going through the legislature right now to try and bring together the different state entities, at least 10 plus divisions, to pull people together around food and to recognize, for Alaskans to recognize all of our connection to food within our work, within our everyday lives. And so I just want to applaud your work, Gary, and to let you know that we're working hard up here. And sorry, I'm going to miss it up there this time, but I don't know if you've done any work with similar groups, food policy councils, to try and kind of create some strength in numbers around some of these issues.
Well, what you're doing is very important work. The food policy council work has just accelerated in the last few years, and I think it's not come too soon. We have some severe challenges facing it, so it's very, very important work, and you have to be diligent at it. So I thank you for your effort with that. And we have a food alliance in Southern Arizona, and just had the first border food summit of bringing all the cultures that live along the borderlands together to talk about our food future. And I think as you made it clear, this isn't just for foodies or academics or farmers or fishermen. This is for everyone that eats. It's for all of us to make the decisions about our food system democratic again, and that takes participation. It just can't be a committee working in isolation. It's really something that I can hear in your tone. We have to welcome other people in with different voices to help forge a shared vision of what our food future should be. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Darren, there's a website, isn't there, for the Food Policy Council now?
Yes, we do have a website. You can Google us. There's also a blog spot, alaskafoodpolicy.blogspot.com. It could be more active, and that's what this is essentially an invitation. We're a very active group with our individual committees. I work on emergency preparedness a lot around how communities are prepared in case there's a disruption in the food chain. And how they can be more prepared, similar to how they were back in the day. 200 and 300 and 1,000 years ago, we were so much more prepared for what could happen compared to nowadays. And it's just kind of we do need to kind of look at that and look at our preparedness and how much food we're getting from the world closer to us instead of transported up.
Yes, indeed. Darren, thank you very much. I'm looking forward for new frontiers and root cellars myself, but I want to get back to these potatoes because, Gary, I think we caught you in basically something that you probably have to caution yourself against all the time in ethnobotany, and that is saying, well, the potatoes were brought in by the white settlers, when we're hearing there's some speculation that actually maybe they were traded up by the indigenous peoples all the way up the West Coast from, who knows, someplace in South America. And I guess this will happen a lot where what's brought forward in the folk knowledge, people say, well, the Irish brought them in, or the Russians. That's just what people are telling one another.
Well, I think you're onto something here. We don't know the exact origin of this potato lineage. People have speculated Peru or Chile. I don't think they pinpointed that, but now these potatoes that are genetically linked have been found from the Monterey Peninsula all the way up your way. And it was someone who is really good at island hopping because it's out on the isolated peninsulas and also the islands at different places. And I think what we do appreciate is that this set of potatoes is unique compared to all the other potatoes in North America that first went to Europe before they came back to, or came to North America. They were in South America, and there are some other little potatoes in Mexico. But these ones, all the other potatoes that we eat in the United States, first went to Europe and were selected in a certain way before they came back. And Haida and Maria's and Tlingit and Macaw potatoes are a story completely different than that story we get in our school books when we were kids.
You can tell the difference. They taste nuttier. They look different. They look almost more knobby, like a Jerusalem artichoke root.
That's right.
Tuber,
and, you know, one of the wonderful things, if I remember correctly, and someone may be able to update this, is that the Macaw schools in Washington are now growing this for restaurants so that the benefits of this being eaten and shared with other people are coming back economically to the Macaw community.
That's great. They could use it. Yeah. Thank you for that. An email coming in from, looks like Megan. Hello, Julianne from Megan in Sitka. Good to hear your voice. I miss all your excellent gardening advice. Your houseplants are still living.
Hi, Megan.
As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the resilience of our food supply and our indigenous foods that we have here in Alaska, valuing them more and perhaps reinvigorating some cultural structure that's really already there and just needs maybe a little bit of encouragement. And with us is Julianne McGinnis, Alaska Botanical Garden, Gary Paul Nabhan of the Sustainable Food Systems Program at the University of Arizona, who will be speaking, and also Rose Meyer of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Kuskokwim campus. And we've only got 10 minutes left, and Paula joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Paula. Well, we lost her. She was going to talk about biodiversity.
That would be Paula Williams of the University of Alaska. She's the sustainability director, and she's speaking at our conference on backyard biodiversity.
Backyard biodiversity?
Yeah.
I got plenty of mine. it just comes in on its own. David sends this. I thought you might like this from Fred John, Katie John's son. The Otna Indians got a name of each group of salmon that go back to their own stream every 5 to 6 years. The old people can look at a salmon they caught in Chitna or Copper Center and tell you the name of the salmon and the stream they spawn in. So Bill Joe, John Billum, and Uncle Pete Ewan told us this. My mother said it was true. That one from David. It's Talk of Alaska, and Julianne, this must be exciting to get really down to the brass tacks of our own Alaska food security here in a gardening context.
Absolutely, and as I was saying, this conference, a central theme besides biodiversity is also food. You know, that we see we have talks on ecological urban design, Tionic Community Garden Project in Food Security, How the Common Vegetable Seed Can Save Us, and an update on farming in rural Alaska, and more. This is on Friday night and Saturday at the Millennium Hotel, and folks can register at our website, www.alaskabg.org.
Well, what happens to me at this conference is I wish that it was longer.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it could go on for weeks.
It could.
Because there's a huge exchange of knowledge, and there's all these people there that I could have learned more from.
There's gardeners and farmers and ethnobotanists all in the same
so
room.
So instead of having two symposia concurrent, you have what, four now, did you say?
We have four sessions going at a time. We have to try to squeeze it all in.
Squeezing it all in.
Julianne, I have a vegetable question for you or maybe for the listeners that I'd love to know when I come up. I've always been fascinated since I was a little kid about the infamous Great Cabbage Contest. And early on, one of the varieties that people used a lot was something called the McFadden cabbage, or that's also known as a Northern Giant. And I don't know if that's really grown much anymore and whether even the seeds are still around. So if any of your listeners or the gardeners involved with the botanical garden programs know about that, I'd love to hear about that when I come up.
That's great. We'll put the word out and see what we can come up with. I think these days the most common variety grown is the OS Cross, but that's a great question for the listening Alaskan public to see if the McFadden varieties out there.
What happens, Gary, with you talk about saving seeds, which is not necessarily all that easy, but I'm kind of wondering, are there repositories and so forth, and how long can you actually keep seeds if they were in a repository?
Well, there's wonderful repositories like the National Seed Storage Lab, but I have to tell you about an innovation here for seed banking. Our Native Seed Search group that I helped found 30 years ago this month paired up with the Tucson Pima County Library System in Arizona. And in 17 different branch libraries around our state now, you can get seeds and check them out just like you check out a book, but you have to promise to bring something back. And so people are checking out seed, growing it out, and then in the fall, giving the library back the seeds that have been regenerated as part of their thanks for growing the vegetable during the summer. So seed banking is now not just something that the government does, but community seed banks, including some of the First Nations communities, now have their own seed banks of their own traditional crops. The Cherokee community in North Carolina also has its own seed center that does seed banking. And some of these things can live in cold storage for decades. The oldest seeds that have been recovered from marshlands are hundreds of years old, but most seeds can't live that long. So the colder and drier the seeds are stored in, which you have a lot of those conditions in Alaska, the longer they can keep. So this is too important to be left up to the government alone. Botanical gardens and even garden clubs now have their own seed banks.
Yeah, Julianne's madly nodding her head here.
Yeah.
Don, go ahead.
Perhaps we need our own Alaskan seed bank here. I know we're doing some work with the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew Millennium Seed Bank in England and trying to preserve Alaskan seeds, Alaskan species, but why not have an Alaskan seed bank?
Well, but the idea of actually having it be a living thing where people actually go ahead and keep bringing in more seeds is really pretty fascinating.
Fantastic. The exchange, yeah.
Very biological. Don joins the program. Don, you're one of the presenters at the conference, right?
I am. I'm speaking about growing our own food. In an urban setting.
Well, tell me how it's going for you.
It's a little slow right now because the sun's just come back, but we have a couple hundred plants started already in windowsills, and we'll have several more going. But I have a more local approach to all this biodiversity and food security, because we grow about 85% of all the food that my family eats right here on our little Nunaka Valley plot.
Wow, Nunaka Valley. I mean, that's blowing some people away if they know the neighborhood. So you're not dealing with very much acreage here, are you?
No, I have about 680 square feet of garden that I grow, put my food on.
Wow. That's inconceivable to me. But, I'm acquainted with some of your methods, and you're one of these people that just keeps messing with it until you get it.
Yeah, it's been a fun experiment because the food tastes so much better than what we can buy that it's fun to say, well, let's try this. What happens if we do this? You know, and
I believe the other thing you told me is I try and eat every bit that I can eat of it.
We do. We eat as much of the plant as we can, for sure. One of the things that, and we don't necessarily wait for everything to look like it does in the grocery store. A lot of the plants we eat much smaller, so that we can get a second harvest out of that spot. And of course, when they're smaller, they're gourmet.
Well, Don, I'm glad you got in touch with us, and I think that's absolutely true. This went in from Bruce Wright from the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. We're making some progress in greenhouses in the Aleut region. In the Aleutians, we're trying to bring food production back to what it was when the Russians influenced the region. And that's quite a story there. Well, I want to thank everybody for being with us. Julianne McGinnis, congratulations. This has been a huge success.
Well, we're glad to have folks sign up for the conference, Spring Garden Conference, Traditions and Transformations, this Saturday and Friday evening and Saturday. So,
Gary, Paul Nabhan, I hope you have a good time when you come up here.
Well, I just thank Julianne for putting together one of the greatest conference venues. The mix of topics is just so much
right.
That we can all learn from.
Thank
so
you.
I'm grateful.
Great. Rose Meyer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to participate.
All right. Next week, Bill Strever, author of Heat. Thanks to Josh Edge, Dave Waldron. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.